صل على محمد وعلى محمد. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين الطيبين. As they say, time flies. You know, it's been very quick. I can't believe that it's the night of the 19th. We have reached and we're approaching Laylatul Qadr, the 23rd of the month of Ramadan. And this shows, it's another reminder that we need to take advantage of the time that we have. We have really no time to lose. Before we know it, it's over. As Amir al-Mu'mineen says, Al-Fursatu tamurru marra as-sahab. Opportunities come and go like clouds. You have to take advantage of them. The month of Ramadan has come, and before we know it, it is approaching its end. I hope that we've been able to benefit from this month up to this night. And if we haven't been able to, or we haven't been able to take advantage as much as we should have and we could have in the opportunity that God provided, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive us on this night and to allow us to make the best of it, the best of this night, the first of the nights, which seems to be a night of preparation for Laylatul Qadr, as inshallah I will explain after Aisha. Over the course of these nights, what we decided to talk about is to bring into perspective two events that we have, one of them being the spiritual opportunity of the month of Ramadan, a time for change, a time for spiritual upliftment, a time to make the decision to look over our lives again, find the flaws, find the issues that we have in our lives as individuals, in our families, in the community we live in. And on the other hand, we have the event of the Shahada of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Salamullah alayh, which tonight is actually the night that this beloved Imam of ours is striked and receives the blow. So because of these two, and that the incident and the incidents that developed to make what happened at the time of the beloved Imam and make this noble Imam go through what he did, those elements and understanding them through the words of the Imam himself are going to be the best set of instructions we can find during this time to try to learn from the flaws, the problems of people before us, and to learn what some of those changes we need to bring about in ourselves are going to be. So for that, we went to the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen, a khutbah that we started to explain, we started to discuss. The khutbah is found in Al-Kafi. The beginning of it reads, or I'll paraphrase in order to save some time. The Imam says, there's two things that I'm fearful of. I have most fear. There are many things in the lives of believers that need to change. As Amir al-Mu'mineen mentions in this khutbah himself as well, many things that should have been changed during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the way the believers saw things, in the way the believers acted, in the way the believers believed their religion told them to pray, to perform Hajj, to use the khums, to use zakat, to pay zakat. In all of those areas, there were many things, many of the details of the ahkam that Amir al-Mu'mineen tells us that needed to be changed. But he says, two things that I fear most are these two traits. If they develop into traits, habits, they become very scary. They become very dangerous. What are they? The first was ittiba'ul hawa, following the desires. If one allows the desires to take over, the desires to control, whatever the desires want, this is one trait that is very dangerous. Amir al-Mu'mineen says, I have a lot of fear. The second one is tulul amal, having wishes that go on and on. There's no end to them. I always want more. There's always wishes that I have for the future in this life. And he says the problem with each of those is the following. He says, أَمَّا اتِّبَاعُ الْهَوَى فَيَصُدُّ عَنِ الْحَقِّ. اتِّبَاعُ الْهَوَى, following the desires, is going to sway one away from, deviate one from haq, and prevent one from following the haq. And the second one, وَأَمَّا طُولُ الْأَمَلِ, having wishes for the future that never seem to reach an end, we always have those wishes. فَيُنْسِي الْآخِرَةِ, the problem with it is that it causes one to forget about the hereafter. We try to explain a bit, to an extent, some of what came to mind about this ittiba'ul hawa, and I want to repeat that question. The question is, what does this exactly mean? What is ittiba'ul hawa, following desires? Is it wrong to follow desires? If it's such that desires are bad, intrinsically, whatever the desires want is bad, then why in the world did God give them to us in the first place? If it's bad to like something that tastes good, if it's bad to enjoy the sexual desire, if it's bad and wrong to enjoy other desires that we have, and if it's wrong for us to go along with what our anger, for example, which is one of these animalistic inclinations that we have, pushes us to do something, if it's wrong to listen to it and allow us to react based on anger, then why did God give them to us in the first place? So we try to, with that question, explore this concept a bit, because there's a lot of different interpretations you would get. For example, we mentioned some of the ulama have encouraged the believers that they not only avoid haram, not only make sure they're engaged in their obligations and do the wajibat and control their hawa, control their desires in that way, but beyond that, to go ahead and take extra measures. What are the extra measures? Avoid the glamour of the dunya. Avoid extravagance. Avoid eating too much. Avoid eating a lot of very tasty food. Having a lot of variety. Avoid having luxury. These are things that some of the ulama have mentioned. Now, when you go to some of the other ulama, and I'm sure you've heard this, when this discussion comes up, is that, so what are we supposed to do as believers? Are we being told that believers don't have the right to enjoy some of the things that others have the right to enjoy? Non-believers are supposed to enjoy the beauties of this world, have large homes, beautiful gardens, nice clothes, nice watches, nice cars, nice gadgets, have all of that. But when it comes to the believers, no, we shouldn't have that. Is this what the religion is telling us? When it comes to the real followers of Amirul Mu'mineen, you're always supposed to find them in areas where the homes are run down. You'll be able to identify a believer with a really run down and beat up car. And if they have a really nice car, then that means they're not a good believer. Believers usually struggle with this idea. On one hand, you have the verses that talk about, as we mentioned, كُلُوا مِن طَيِّبَاتِ مَا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ, take from the bounties, take from the blessings, from the tayyibat that God has provided. When people try to restrict beyond wajib and haram, put more restrictions, the verses of the Holy Quran explain that this is wrong, you can't do that. It's interesting that this is a recurring event. It's happened throughout time, plenty of times, that you have people that create restrictions that are beyond religious restrictions. They create limitations that are more than what Islam says in certain areas of life. Those same people, when it comes to other areas of life, they remove restrictions. So you restrict things one way and you leave it open the other way. The way that the world is set up and the way things need to function the relationships need to function, the restrictions need to be the way they are. When you find someone that's very free and very open in a certain arena, when you look at something else in their life, you will see that they are actually very, very strict on certain other things. Where Islam says be strict, you're not strict. Where Islam says don't be strict, you're strict. This is usually what happens. Before Islam, this is how it was. People were into many different haram activities. The Jews made usury halal for themselves, but they would create restrictions for themselves that were not in the Torah. Certain things that were not restrictions, they made them into restrictions. Certain things that were restrictions, they removed them. So to them, when they created restrictions beyond what God had set as restrictions, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, كُلُوا مِن طَيِّبَاتِ مَا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ. Take from the طَيِّبَات. At times when the Prophet would be told, well, this isn't this the glamour of the dunya? Isn't this something that is the zina of the dunya? The verses came down. Who says that the zina of the dunya is haram? Who says it's wrong to have the beautiful things in this world? So then when you talk about this concept, avoiding the glamour of the dunya, it becomes very confusing. Where do you draw the line? How do you figure out, how do you live your life where you're actually following the footsteps of Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi? It's interesting, when you look at the lives of the Ahlul Bayt, you'll find this as well. People used to criticize Imam al-Sadiq because of him wearing clothing that was appropriate for his time. It was clothing that looked nice, looked presentable. People would come and approach him and criticize him and critique him and say, your grandfather Amir al-Mu'mineen used to wear clothes that do not resemble the ones you're wearing. They were not soft and comfortable fabrics that he would use. They didn't look presentable the way yours are. When they would rip, he would sew them back. He wouldn't wear something that was new. And they critiqued the imams on that. Imam al-Sadiq said, you got it wrong. So when we get all of this, it becomes very confusing. How do we do this? How do we make sure that we are not becoming some of those that are following their desires? We want to understand this, to then understand and see how historically what Amir al-Mu'mineen says, this is the most fearful trait that the people can develop within them. And we'll see how that translates into what happened and transpired at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen and caused many problems later on as well. How do we do this? We started to discuss in the previous session that what we need to understand is what our desires actually are. Our desires are God-given blessings to take care of our material needs. However, the desires only look at what? The desires only look at your material needs. The desire to eat only takes care of eating. That's all it cares about. It doesn't care about the desire to eat. Doesn't think long term. It doesn't think long term. Even in this world, it doesn't think long term. If you have food in abundance, but it's in abundance for now, if you don't control the way you eat, you're going to have a shortage in a month, in 2 months. Desire doesn't care about what happens in the next 1 or 2 months and you're going to have a shortage. What the desire cares about is right now fulfilling that desire. That's all it cares about. Have you seen cattle, sheep, and cows? If you look at them, if you watch them, they don't worry about anything. The only thing when they're hungry that they worry about is what's in their vicinity, the food that they can graze on. They'll have their heads down, grazing on the grass around them. That's all they care about. Is this something that's going to run short and I'm going to have to save for later? Doesn't matter. It's going to eat it all up. And then when it's done, if there's no more, it's just going to die. Even from a material perspective, the animal's desire only cares about that very specific and particular need. Now let's generalize that and not talk about specific desires. All of our desires are only catering to what? To our needs in this dunya. Okay. All of our desires cater to the needs in this dunya. The other thing that we have is an intellect, a God-given intellect, that looks beyond this world. It looks in this world further than just today and this hour and next day and next week and so on. It thinks about the future. And also it can look beyond that and look at after death as well, if it can understand that. The way we understand in Islam, we're going to balance this life of ours. The way we're going to understand how to balance where we're taking care of our needs, those God-given desires are being fulfilled. At the same time, we don't become some of those that are following their desires. Remember, we said that the needs of this dunya and the desires that we have, it's sort of addictive. It's not only cigarettes that are addictive. The dunya, the glamour of the dunya is addictive. You have one bit, you get tired of it after a bit. You want something better, something new that comes. You always want variety, you want more. You're never going to be satisfied, okay? And that process is going to continue until it just takes over your life and you become someone that has ittiba'ul hawa. That's what happens. Gradually it leads to that. So if we want to fulfill those desires, and we need to, they're God-given. On the other hand, we have other goals. So practically, how are we supposed to do this? I would like to use an example to help us understand this. What is the example? The example is driving. Let's take the example of driving. I think it's a relatively good example for us to understand this. When you're driving, the road you have is going to direct you towards your destination, right? The road you're driving on is directing you towards your destination. If you've gone on those highways, interstate highways, especially in states where they're pretty flat and you don't have much greenery, you see clear distinction. This is the road. If you go off course, then you're going to be going in the desert, all right? You're going to go right in the middle of nowhere, okay? If you want to get to your destination, you're going to keep to that road. What's going to keep you to the road? You have markers on the road that identify this is the road. If you go beyond this, especially on turns, you see, they have those signs. Don't go straight here. Be careful. There's a sharp curve. You need to start turning, all right? You have all those signs to make sure you're going straight or you're proceeding on the path that you have towards your destination, right? But those markers on the road are not going to get you to your destination, are they? It's not your marker that's going to get you to your destination. If you're trying to go from Dallas to Houston, just knowing the markers on the road, if you just look at the markers on the road and just have your head down and look at the markers, you're going to miss the highway that's going to go towards Houston. You're going to end up going towards, I don't know, Austin or towards Arkansas. Okay. Just looking at the markers is not going to get you to the destination. You have to observe that, but there's something else you need to observe as well. What is that? You got to know where your destination is, constantly remind yourself of where the destination is, and make sure you're following that map that's going to and taking you to that destination. And depending on how much of a want you have to get to your destination, and how much of a rush you have to get to your destination, you're going to be stepping on that pedal either harder or you're going to take your time. If you're in a rush, you really want to get there, then you're going to be breaking all the laws on the speed limits to get there on time. But if you're not really worried, you're going to be driving like a Sunday driver, and you're going to get there. You could get there in 4 hours. You get there in 6 hours. No problem. Not an issue. I don't have any issue. The markers on the road are not going to get you there. You need to know where you're headed. In the Islamic teachings we have, and interestingly enough, in what we just read of the saying of Amirul Mu'mineen, this is what we're told. The markers on the road are your halal and haram. It's your wajib. You got to make sure you're doing that. You got to make sure you don't go off course. You got to make sure in order to satisfy your desires, you're not going off of the main road. The beauty of the scenery on the side of the road is not attracting you to it. So instead of going to somewhere where it's a lot more beautiful, where your destination is, you'll end up stopping at a very local park that is not half as beautiful as the destination you're looking for and to get to. It's going to distract you and you're going to go off course. Those boundaries, the wajib and the haram, are going to be those road marks so that you don't go off course. But that's not enough. What do you need to have? The Imam tells us. He said two things, remember? He said, ittiba' al-hawa is one problem. The problem that has is that it takes you off path. It takes you off the road. فَيَصُدُّ عَنِ الْحَقِّ There's something else he said. He said, according to the hadith, طُولُ الْأَمَلِ Having a lot of wishes about the dunya, what's the effect of it? It says, فَيُنْسِي الْآخِرَةِ It makes you forget your actual destination. That becomes the problem. You forget about where you're actually headed. You forget about life after death. We forget about death itself. We forget about what's going to happen after death. That's the destination. See, the desires are just worried about here. This is not the destination. It's just benefiting from what's around the road, but we're not moving towards the destination. If we have the boundaries set, brothers and sisters, if we understand what the halal and the haram, the wajib and the halal are, we know what the limitation and restrictions are. That's very important. But beyond that, how do I make a decision? Should I buy an extra car? Should I not buy an extra car? Should I buy this car or is this too much? Should I spend that money on something else? Should I buy this house or, again, this is too much? This meal, should I go to the restaurant this many times? Should I not? Right? Those questions are going to be understood not by dry-cut rules. You're not going to get dry cut rules that, okay, a car over $30,000 or $40,000 or whatever the limit is going to be haram. No, we don't have dry cut rules. The rules that are definite are the wajib and haram. You got to make sure you're within those limits. Beyond that, the remembrance of the akhirah, the destination, and learning more about it, understanding death, understanding life after death, understanding paradise, understanding hell, this is what is going to cause one to feel, wait a second, if I really want to get to the destination, and I have a limited amount of time, I don't have all day, I don't have too much time, as Amirul Mu'mineen says in many of his sayings, he warns us, says the path is a very lengthy one, but the time we have, the life we have, is very short. Those reminders are going to cause one to think twice. If I don't need this, then yeah, it's not haram. But I can use my time more wisely. I can use my money more wisely. Why should I use it for something that will not be there in a few years? Why should I use it for something that will not benefit me, nor my family, And it's actually going to cause us problems in this world and in the hereafter. One starts thinking more. And they start realizing, okay, this is not something to waste my time on. And they will realize that sometimes, no, it's actually okay and even good to buy something relatively expensive. When you want to invite someone over, don't say, okay, now we want to have zuhud. Ittiba'ul hawa isn't good. Let's only serve one type of food. No, when you're inviting guests, be generous. Show generosity. That's going to be for the ukhra. That's not for the dunya. That's not a desire. Unless it's overdoing it to show that I have a lot. Yeah, that can happen too. I want to make people think that I'm generous. That's the reason why I'm doing this. I'm not doing it because I actually want to be generous. I'm doing it because I want to make people think I'm generous. This is briefly the instruction we get from Amirul Mu'mineen about how to deal with our lives. If he says, اتباعُ الْهَوَى and طُولُ الْأَمَالِ, it's because the combination of those. If we get rid of both of those, we're not following our desires, we're not going off course, we're doing our wajibat, we're avoiding our muharramat, we make sure we know those. If we're doing that, and we don't have a lot of wishes about this world, we're not constantly thinking about what I can have next, but rather, I start remembering the hereafter, reminding myself of the short time that I have, that's going to automatically shape the way my life is going to be beyond just simply wajib and haram. Then you don't need instructions anymore to tell you, oh, this is specifically haram, or this is specifically something that's wrong. You'll start to get the hang of how to steer this. See, when you're driving, that's why I mentioned the example of driving. There's certain rules that you have that you need to abide by, but there's a lot of things that come back to your judgment after knowing what your destination is, where your destination is, and you know those dry cut rules that you need to abide by, then there's a lot of other decisions that you're going to have to gauge based on your wisdom and your knowledge of what's going on. You'll see how close you are, for example, to the next car. You have to look around. Is there a car next to you when you want to change lanes, or is it not? When do you start changing lanes? You need to start very early. When it's traffic, it's one way. When you're not in traffic, it's another way. When you're if you're in Texas, it's one way. When in another state, it's a different way. There's a lot of things that come back to sound judgment that one needs to have. But using these two parameters, those rules, and looking at the destination we have. Recite a salawat, please. Now we want to look at, in the time we have, start looking at what Amirul Mu'mineen meant. Let's look at that historic example and see how devastating this concept of ittiba'ul hawa can be. We raised this question and we started reading this hadith to answer this question. What happened and why was it that the best man on the face of the earth, not only the best man from the perspective of worship, from the perspective of prayer, from the perspective of giving charity, from the perspective of avoiding sins, from the perspective of having fear of Allah and wanting to meet his Lord, but the best person also from the perspective of managing the society that he lived in and being the imam that leads his nation. The best knowledgeable man, the best capable and competent in being able to handle matters of the society he lived in. He was the best political leader that anyone could imagine on the face of the earth. Yet, with all the competency that he had, with all the abilities and the knowledge he had, we see, unlike the first three khalifas, or the first two khalifas, we would say, that were able to live pretty much to the end of their lives, and they didn't have, at the very least, public uprisings against them. They didn't have people complaining too much about them. Yes, during the time of Uthman, we had somewhat of that, and that's what ended Uthman's term and Uthman's khilafah. But during the time of the first two khalifas, we didn't have public uprisings the way we did during the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, at the very least. If he's so capable, if he's so competent, then why is it that he has to fight three battles, two of which are very clearly battles with his own people, with people that he's leading, the community that he's leading? Why? And we said Amir al-Mu'mineen tells us, اتباعُ الْهَوَى. When you have a community, and let me remind us that we want to look at this because we're trying to see the problem that causes problems for us as individuals, for us within the families we live in, and for the community. This has lessons for all those three layers. What happened if you have a community that has collectively started to move towards ittiba'ul hawa? You can't have an imam leading it. That's a very serious problem. If society's direction is following the desires, an imam can't lead it. I'll briefly mention this, then we'll look at the historic account and what happened, how this gradually happened, to teach us a lot of lessons. The imam himself told us, in this khutbah, that's why we selected this. He said, اتباعُ الْهَوَى. What does it cause? فَيَصُدُّ عَنِ الْحَقِّ. If عَلِيٌّ مَعَ الْحَقِّ وَالْحَقُّ مَعَهُ, as the hadith says from the Holy Prophet, Ali is with the truth, and truth is always with him, right? So he wants to take the society, the nation that he's leading, towards haqq. But if the society is following their desires, then what's going to happen? يَصُدُّ عَنِ الْحَقِّ. It's going to prevent you. You don't want to move in that direction. The imam says, go this way. You say, no, go the other way. That's why it's a very serious problem. This is a very serious problem in our communities. If it becomes something that's part of our community, that the majority of people, the direction in their life, yes, just like the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen, everybody believes in God. Everybody believes in the hereafter. Everybody prays five times. Everybody fasts during the month of Ramadan. Everybody tries to go to Hajj. Everybody goes for ziyarah. Everybody has all of those. But that's not the direction. As Amir al-Mu'mineen says here, quoting the Holy Prophet in the continuation of this hadith, the Holy Prophet has already warned. He says that the a'mal that are supposed to be for the hereafter are going to start serving the purpose of the dunya, the hawa. That's why it's a very serious problem. And the solution to this problem is for us as individuals and as communities to start trying to move away from that. Only if we do that, we're going to see results. Only if we do that, then we will be ready to be led by an imam. Let's look at that history, how it happened, because it's important. How does this develop? How does it become a social problem that the society, a nation, is collectively looking at it overall, not all individuals? Because you'll have people like Amir al-Mu'mineen in that society. But society overall is moving in the direction that you would say they are following their desires. How does this happen? How did it happen? When we look at the history of the Ahlul Bayt, we see that the Holy Prophet did the reverse of this. The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, over the course of the 23 years of his prophethood, did a fabulous job, an extraordinary job, something that is truly not comprehensible for us if we understand the extent of what he did and the impact he had. He had the reverse effect. He took a society, a nation that he was part of, that knew nothing but desires, knew nothing but this world. They actually believed, their ideology was there's nothing but this world, and after death it's all over. Okay? That's what they really believed. When the Holy Prophet said there's life after death, they would take bones that had sort of decomposed and they would take it to the Prophet and they would crush it and turn it into power. It's pouring. They said to the Prophet, "O Prophet, you're saying that this is going to come back to life?" They couldn't believe it. The only thing they see is material desire, and they would do everything for it. Killing babies was easy for them to save their own lives. We have two sets of verses in the Holy Quran about this, because we had two different types of people with two different sets of desires. One set of people, they would kill their own children. Why? Because they were afraid they're not going to be able to provide for themselves and for the child. They were afraid that providing for the child was going to spread them too thin, and they're not going to provide for themselves. Because they had the need to eat and drink themselves, they would kill human beings for that. Of course, this is something that unfortunately is taking place in this day and age as well, and it's something that is completely acceptable, unfortunately. And you can understand the extent of the jahiliyyah that's happening right now. That people, for their own desires, for their own worldly benefit, easily abort a child that has even developed into its final stages of development. And they say this is a right you have. A mother has that right. Jahili. At that time it was similar. The only thing is the child would be born, and they would, with cold blood, go and kill that child in order to save themselves. You had another set of people that would kill their children, not because they were afraid that they wouldn't have enough to survive themselves, but look, the stupidity. They would kill that child because they were afraid that they wouldn't have enough funds to support the whole family, and that would cause them to lose their integrity, their dignity, their image. In order to save the image they had in the community they lived in, they would kill people. They would kill their own children, and they wouldn't find it problematic. They would get into ridiculous fights, kill somebody over it, easily. It's all about this dunya. People who understood nothing but desires, but this dunya, but following the hawa, as the hadith tells us. The Holy Prophet came to a community like that. Gradually he built it. He changed the direction. Now we can start to see why Amirul Mu'mineen says these two are important. First, the Holy Prophet starts giving them direction. Look, you have a God that has created you not for this world, but for the hereafter. Those two beliefs start being stressed upon. Those are the two things that come first. Many of the laws are not there yet. Many of those red lines are not introduced yet. First thing that needs to happen, direction. Look, you have a God that's non-material. Try to get your head up from the ground you're looking at and simply grazing like cattle. Look up and start seeing there's other things that exist. God exists. God is your creator. This world is not what you're been created for. The Holy Prophet started doing that. People started gathering around him. Once the direction was corrected and people started praying to remind themselves of that direction, gradually those borders and those limitations started to form and say, okay, if you want to move in that direction, then you got to avoid this. You got to avoid that. And gradually, the Holy Prophet gradually introduced the rule of drinking, for example. Drinking was something that believers in Mecca were doing. They would come and pray, but they would drink as well. They hadn't avoided it. The rule hadn't come. Gradually, God sent down the rule that, look, if you want to go for prayer, don't be drunk then. All right? You're taking steps. It's a gradual process. Don't be drunk when you go to pray. Make sure when you're praying, you're not drunk. Then eventually, drinking is prohibited completely. And then there's a penal law, actually. If you drink, now that the society has started moving in the right direction, if somebody within the society wants to start moving in the wrong direction and they openly start drinking, not only is it banned, that person is going to get lashed 80 times. society has to be kept moving in the right direction. He introduced other rules. The rule of hijab was introduced, as we call it, or satr, as some of the ahadith have it, covering females, sisters that have been given God-given beauty. We're told that they're supposed to cover that up, except for, to a certain extent, their fathers, their grandfathers, their siblings, and others, uncles, and so on and so forth, and to a larger extent, for their husband, they're not supposed to cover. Beyond that, the beauty needs to be covered up. It shouldn't be displayed. Otherwise, it's going to cause what? It's going to cause ittiba'ul hawa. It's going to cause society to move in the wrong direction. These rules started to gradually come, brothers and sisters, towards the end, and even in the midst of the training that the Holy Prophet gave to these people changed from understanding nothing but this material world and following the desires and killing others for their own personal desires. They came to a state where people, believers, would shed tears to be able to go join the jihad of the Holy Prophet that was not to protect their personal gains and desires, but rather to protect Islam and to take Islam to the rest of the Arabian Peninsula and the Arabian people. They would sacrifice their lives to give this great blessing of Allah to other people. See the change, the contrast? From a people that only follow their desires, the Holy Prophet, over the course of the 23 years of his prophethood, brings them to a stage where people collectively are not only avoiding sins, but they are not really interested in the glamour of the dunya. When the Holy Prophet says, pick brothers from amongst yourselves and split what you have between you, which is something I find it very difficult. If I was told today that I would have to split everything I have with one of the members of this community, I would have an issue. Honestly, I don't think any of us would be ready. But the Holy Prophet told people this, and they willingly did that. They willingly went and selected a brother from the Muhajirin. The Ansar and the Muhajirin were paired up, and they shared everything that they had. From killing people for the limited gain they would get, changing to people that would split everything they had with another person that they didn't even know, that's not even related to them. Okay, see how the Holy Prophet changes it? If I were to just speak about what type of change the Holy Prophet brought to what type of people, it would take hours and we would still not be done. This is what the Holy Prophet did. One of the other things to take into consideration is that the culture change that the Holy Prophet did, he made that into culture. There's a time where, let's say, I come to you, brothers and sisters, and I'm able to affect you, let's say, and affect you positively, that you're able to start doing something correctly in your community. Let's just say that. Okay, I don't think I'll be able to, but let's say I was. Okay. Not because you guys are stubborn, but because I'm incapable. If I were to come and do that and then leave, next day everything goes back to normal, right? Everything goes back to what it was. The Holy Prophet changed the culture of the people over the course of 23 years in a way that it wasn't easy for the Khulafa to change that culture. When the Khulafa would want to change the culture, people would object. Khulafa would want to go back to what it was prior to Islam, people would object. So this is where the decline starts. Okay. During the time of the Khulafa, things started to happen. The first thing that happened, which everyone knows, and this is the first step in the wrong direction, was Khilafah itself. There's a reason why the leader of the Muslim nation has got to be the most pious, the most knowledgeable, and the most competent and capable of taking care of the affairs of the believers. There's a reason for it. The most capable, the most pious, the most knowledgeable, Amir al-Mu'mineen, who is ma'soom, Amir al-Mu'mineen, who is the one that carries the knowledge of Nubuwwah after the Holy Prophet, he's supposed to lead. Because if he leads, he's going to, as we said, according to the hadith, he is ma'al haq wal haqqu ma'ah. Truth is with him. He's going to lead the community in that direction, continuing and taking people from where the Holy Prophet left off, continuing that. He would have done that, but that changed. That's the first wrong decision that was made. And Amir al-Mu'mineen, as we know, did what he could to try to correct that. That itself is a very long story. I haven't discussed that here. I'm sure you've heard many things on that. But I think it is a subject and a topic that deserves revisiting every now and then. It deserves thinking and pondering. And it deserves us not to simply recycle the material that we've heard sometimes with the same exact wording every year and just say that over and over and not develop a further understanding of what actually happened there. That's a very important thing for us to understand. We have a lot of misconceptions about what happened straight after the demise of the Holy Prophet. We have a lot of misunderstandings about what Amir al-Mu'mineen did straight after and right after the demise of the Holy Prophet. And we have a lot of misunderstandings about what Amir al-Mu'mineen's stance was after a couple of years, until the time that he became the Khalifa. There's a lot to study in that. But that's not something that I'm going to talk about and discuss. I want to talk about how the people that had become so pious that they would give lives for Allah, they would want to leave this world and meet Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They would tell the Holy Prophet, you've heard the story of the young man. In the morning, the Holy Prophet sees him and he looks like he hasn't slept well at night. The Holy Prophet speaks to him and asks him, Kaifa asbah? How are you this morning? And the man says, I have gotten up this morning and the way I am this morning is that I wasn't able to sleep last night. Why? He says, because the cry of the people in hell didn't allow me. I'm hearing their cry. I'm not able to sleep right. Look at the spiritual elevation. Material desires to this man mean nothing. He's reached the station where he understands there's a lot more important things. And he tells, it's a long story he describes, and the Holy Prophet asks him for signs. But the last thing he says is this. This is the culture that the Holy Prophet has brought to these people. He says, O Prophet of God, pray that I reach the rank of Shahada. I want Shahada. What happened that from that position, that culture of the Holy Prophet, you come to what station and what situation? What is the circumstance at the time of Amir al-Mu'mineen? We need to discuss that as well, and I will, inshallah, in the following nights. But one bit of it that is related to tonight as well, and we'll end off and end on this note. The shahada of the Imam himself and the individual that carried out this crime that the mal'oon Muawiyah later on had some of the companions of the Holy Prophet fabricate hadith and say that Ibn Muljam, the Mal'oon, was a very pious man, and he fabricated hadith to say Amir al-Mu'mineen was someone that was not following the teachings of the Holy Prophet, and verses were revealed against him. This Mal'oon, Ibn Muljam, if you look at him, look at the time, that youth at the time of the Holy Prophet asking for Shahada, look at Ibn Muljam. Ibn Muljam is supposed to be what? He's supposed to be a Khawariji. He's one of the Khawarij. What do you know the Khawarij as? You understand the Khawarij as being people that are very interested in worship. They're very interested in prayers. They're very interested in prostration, recitation of the Quran, right? This is the image you get. They say Ibn Muljam swore by God with a few of his friends in Masjidul Haram by the Kaaba to kill three individuals, Ali ibn Abi Talib, Muawiyah, and Amr ibn As. So they swore to God over there, right? But listen to this. See, Ittiba'ul Hawa, which there's a lot of Ittiba'ul Hawa even there, but very clear examples of it. It says that Ibn Muljam, when he came to Kufa, he started to think twice about doing what he had promised to do. You know what caused, recite a salawat please. Let's finish this with... You know what got Ibn Muljam to go and kill Amirul Mu'mini? It's because he saw this young lady that attracted his attention and had a lot of beauty. And she had grievances against Amirul Mu'mineen because she believed that the death of her father and brother were because of Amirul Mu'mineen. She used her God-given beauty to attract the heart of this young man. And so Ibn Muljam, according to the accounts, killed Ali ibn Abi Talib because of a woman. From the time of the Holy Prophet, where people would want and desire shahada to someone that kills the best person on the face of earth because of desires, because of a woman. How did that change occur? How did that change occur? It's something that we're going to have to discuss over the course of the following nights. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to grant us knowledge and the ability to implement it. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to allow us on this night to make the best du'as, and that He grants us what we wish and what we ask Him, if they are best for us, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, alhamdulillah rabbil alamin.
If I can have your attention for a few minutes. Just wanted to give an update on the program schedule and the format. Tonight, right after Salatul Isha, we will start the majlis with Salam and Mercier at 10:15. And at 10:30, we will have the speech and majlis by Hamza Sadagar. And 11:10, we will have the matam. And 11:30, we will have the basic amal for the night. The basic amal will start at 11:30. And at 12, we will have a short break, followed by online tamal. And at 3:30, we will have the sair. For tomorrow, that is the 19th of Ramadan, the program will start at 7 p.m. with the recitation of Holy Quran. At 7 p.m. for the recitation of Holy Quran. And at 7:30, we will have Salam and Mercier. And at 7:50, we will have a speech by Maulana Hamza Sadagar. And 8:35, we will have Matam. And 8:55, we will have Salat al-Maghrib, followed by Salat al-Isha at 10 p.m. And then we will have Dua Kamal by Sheikh Hamza Sadagar, followed by Dua Iftita. On the 20th Ramzan, that is Friday, the format will remain same, 7 p.m. recitation of Holy Quran. The only change would be